I'm Bill Castle, and this is Free Expression. This program is all about conveying the Christian message from a Catholic point of view and defending the liberty which makes it possible to do that. We talk with creative, interesting people examining how churches and Christian principles are exploited to advance radical causes, in particular the movement for so-called animal rights. Join us. Sit back and enjoy some free expression. Religion have always been connected. The ancient Israelites sacrificed various foodstuffs in the temple. Today, observant Jews maintain kosher food restrictions. To Catholics, the act of eating has sacramental significance in the Eucharist or communion, which is at the center of every Mass. But while it's a Catholic practice to abstain from meat on certain days of the year, church doctrine does not require us to be vegetarians. We're instructed to be humane in our treatment of animals, but meat is definitely on the diet for most Catholics. In recent years, a movement has grown up that insists animals have rights, not unlike those of people, in fact. Some who hold that view are quite aggressive in their attacks on farms and food producers. They often invoke Christian principles to justify their actions. What does the Bible say about our obligations toward these other creatures? Wes Jameson is a communications specialist who has examined that question in a book titled, What Would Jesus Really Eat? The Biblical Case for Eating Meat. Wes, thanks very much for being with us.
It's fantastic to be here, Bill. Thank you.
Give us a little background on the animal rights movement and its attitude toward meat and meat producers.
The animal rights movement really originates in the 19th century. In response to things like the industrial use of animals as draft animals and bear baiting, things like that. It's always been located within Western society. You don't really see animal rights, much less animal welfare, but animal rights in cultures that don't have a degree of affluence, or certainly the Eastern cultures that don't have the same worldview regarding individuality and individual protection through rights. So it's pretty much, it always has been, located in industrialized or affluent Western societies. The movement waxes and wanes over time, so it comes and goes. In its latest iteration, beginning in the 1970s, it became more radical in saying that animals just didn't deserve protection. They actually had fundamental rights. There's two views in the movement. One would be the rights view forwarded by a guy named Tom Regan. The other one would be sort of a utilitarian philosopher view forwarded by Peter Singer. Both of them end up in the same place, that animals are to be protected from human exploitation or even human use.
We should distinguish here. We're not talking about animal protection as in animal shelters and that sort of thing. We're talking about...
Great clarification. We're talking about the cessation of human use of animals.
Right.
We're not talking about taking shelter pets or truly abused animals on the street and nursing them back to health. We're talking about ending the human use of animals generally across the board. Basically, what was happening, Bill, is the movement had spent its fervor by the early 1980s, certainly by 1990, and a French philosopher basically said that ultimately all political movements are religious. And there's an entire literature that points to the need of political movements to use religion as a way to forward themselves. So you start seeing in 2002, animal rights philosophers start saying Christianity and Christian beliefs were the last bulwark preventing the implementation of a animal rights agenda. So what has happened certainly since, I would say, the late 90s, accelerating through the 2000s, has been the co-optation, the attempt to take over Christian language to make the case that religion, Christianity, actually defines animals in a different way that would be considered orthodox over time. And that's kind of what happened. It was a marriage of necessity. People are using religion in the Imago Dei, to use Latin terms, the image of God. People are created in the image of God and may use animals. If that's the last bulwark in their political movement to end animal use.
Is it your impression that these people are sincere in their religious beliefs, or is this just a sly effort to co-opt Christian concepts and Christian language?
Yes. So it's both. there are indeed many what I would call weak, doctrinally weak, people who are sincere in believing that their religion, now I'm going to talk primarily about Protestantism and Catholicism, their religion would prohibit them from using animals or certainly using animals that come from certain origins, like confinement farms. But there's a lot of evidence that the leaders of the movement have been what I would say diabolical in its truest sense of the word in the attempt to divide, and also sophisticated in their use of religion for political purposes. And you'll see on their documents, they will proof text and selectively fruit pick from Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Islam. They will pick and choose whatever texts are necessary out of context to make the case that people should not, morally, should not be eating animals because religion prohibits it. And that's very sophisticated, intentional, in fact, cynical.
How do they deal with the fact that Jesus is recorded to have eaten fish? The Last Supper would have been a Seder meal at which the central dish would have been lamb. How do they finesse that?
Well, there's, again, a spectrum. Christians, small c, in name only. Philosophers have said that Jesus himself was abusing animals in doing so. That would be one extreme. The other extreme would say that basically what I would call a postmillennial view, that Jesus was accommodating to his culture at the time while calling for sort of a universal ethic of peace, restoration of the creation to the pre-fall order, and that they would proof text Daniel 1 and elsewhere that evidences that vegetarianism is the right way. So they proof text out of context that it was a vegetarian world prior to the flood, that Jesus was coming to institute a new kingdom that was more or less a postmillennial view. And so they finesse it by proof texting and then picking obscure sources from church history and paraphrasing them to basically say that Jesus was trying to say, to point like a moral teacher mode, here's a new and better way. The lion will lay down with the lamb. Right? There will be no predation. There'll be no need for eating meat. And he was showing the way because, after all, he kept the kosher laws. Jesus, while his ministry on earth, was indeed kosher. So clearly, the idea, if they're pointing to Jesus and say, clearly the pork industry, the shellfish industry, any cloven-footed animal was off limits. So if we're going to follow Jesus' example, we need to stop the pork industry outright and the shellfish industry. So what they'll do, Bill, is they'll selectively proof text out of context sources that try to make the case that Jesus was leading us in a moral example to a more peaceable kingdom where animal consumption doesn't happen.
What kinds of activities are they mounting in religious circles? Are they trying to actually get these messages into preaching? Or are they conducting Yes. church-based programs? What's going on?
So, for instance, you can go to the Humane Society of the United States website, and it was certainly more pronounced in the early 20-teens, like 2008, 2010, 2011, but they had an entire section on religion and animals where they would produce sermons, Sunday school lessons, and resources to distribute to churches to use in teaching about animals. So that was more of a formal approach. Informally, their leaders would work with what I would call old mainline Protestant denominations that are hierarchical, for instance, Methodists, right. Episcopalians, to go from top down through the leadership of the denomination to institute doctrinal statements regarding animals that reflected their views. So it was bottom up, organically, through teaching, both in the pulpit and in Sunday school, and top down through the denominational leaders. And it's been a focused effort now for 20 years. And they spend an enormous amount of money to do this. Also, they fund theologians, philosophers to write books, to make compelling cases. And then when someone like Matthew Scully comes out with Dominion, which was a very sophisticated, tangentially Roman Catholic view, then they give them a podium and they become a cause. They advance his case for them on their behalf. That's been their strategy. And basically, the difficulty they've had is people still have not surrendered largely in relation to animals, the idea of the Imago Dei, that people are unique. We're created in the image of God where animals aren't, and then the concept of dominion. So really the three things that have thwarted them, I'll call them echo, of doctrinal beliefs about human exceptionalism, Imago Dei, and dominion. People still intuitively, even if they're not schooled theologically, believe we have the right to use animals and that we're fundamentally different. That hasn't stopped the movement from making incremental, very slow changes. And the way they've done it, Bill, is they've come in through pet ownership. Their principal target would be a ill-theological, I don't want to say atheological, a believer in a denomination that really doesn't understand church history or doctrine, who owns pets and largely views them as members of the family. That's been their target audience.
But isn't there even an objection to pets as such, the idea that people have the right to own another creature? I've seen that argument raised, that this is essentially immoral.
Yes, but that's isolated what I would call the cognitive elites in the movement, the philosophers and the ideologues. It's very much located there. You won't hear in the day-to-day push of politics, even PETA, which is what has traditionally been the most extreme organization, they have shied away from pet ownership as an issue because they understand, they know who butters their bread. The constituent for animal rights group are highly educated, pet-owning suburban females. Now, yes, there's men in the movement, but the data very clearly shows that pet ownership is really, really high among those who donate money to the Humane Society of PETA. So, obviously, philosophically, they'd want to be pure and say it's slaveholding.
Yeah.
But practically, they can't go there because that's a bridge too far for them. They would lose donations overnight.
To what extent are these ideas really getting traction? It seems to me that what you say about people's fundamental love of meat is certainly a natural source of resistance. I have a dear friend who's a priest, and he's one of the biggest fans of bacon you'll ever want to meet.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Who isn't? Here's an interesting fact, by the way, just for your listeners about bacon, and I'll answer your question. There was, I believe it's the British Journal Lancet. There is an article reporting research in England in a British medical journal noting that 92% of vegetarians fall back into meat eating because of one principal temptation, and that would be the smell of bacon. So
it's powerful.
Question,
there's no doubt. That's a powerful.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, you are kidding. But basically, radical and purely ideological movements never capture society, but they make slow, inexorable, incremental changes in the overall worldview of their targets. So, yeah, there's been no legislation banning animal use, but what you'll see is things like in California, slowly and surely, consumers are becoming attuned to the argument that farm animals are abused. So they're not banning it. What they're doing is they're incrementally passing legislation that is very, very amenable to a suburban, meat-consuming, pet-owning public about treat the animals better. Here's their basic argument to bring about the incremental change. You wouldn't, you live with one animal as a companion, another one is cuisine. One animal is at the center of your heart, the other animal's on the center of your plate. You're a hypocrite. That's their argument at its essence. But they offer atonement, a sense of secular atonement and penance, by saying you don't have to give up meat, you just need to give money to purchase your guilt. And so, look, you should feel guilty. You treat a dog as if it's a member of the family, a child. And yet a pig, by every measure, is more intelligent. Don't stop eating pork. Just help us help the pig by giving it more space, by giving it more understanding. And that relieves the cognitive dissonance in the listener by saying, see, I'm doing something. And so the goal here is to raise the cost of production so high by incremental legislation that basically animal companies can't be competitive to continue raising animals. Now, there is all kinds of evidence that that is succeeding slowly, surely, over time. In fact, there was just a Supreme Court case heard in October on this very issue. California had passed legislation banning the importation and sale of animal products that have been raised in certain confinement techniques by making the case it's inhumane. So California pet owners, look what's happening to these pigs in Iowa. If they're going to sell them here, they have to raise them according to California standards. And the animal industry, before the Supreme Court, argued it was basically a de facto trade barrier tariff. So behind the scenes, there is enormous battles taking place, trying to both advance that model, what I would call secular atonement penance, versus trying to stall it or stop it so that there would be a free flow of goods based from animals around the states.
Where does that case stand?
The opinion should come out relatively quickly. I thought it would be out by now. It'll certainly be out by June. And then obviously, and interestingly enough, Humane Society and an amicus, a friend of the court brief, along with California, I believe the AG, but whoever argued the case, made the case that California citizens had the right to institute moral legislation against practices that they believed were immoral. So they expressly moralized the debate. For instance, if the citizens of Alabama believe that abortion is morally wrong, should they not be allowed, it's a states' rights argument, should they not be allowed then to ban abortion? So if the citizens of the state of California believe it's immoral to put a pig into a confined cage, should they not be allowed to ban it on moral terms? Hmm. So we're starting to see for the first time, almost expressly and explicitly, religious arguments used in the court.
Very interesting. There's certainly a certain irony in that.
Isn't there? You're right.
Is there an extreme fringe to this movement, as, for instance, there is an extreme fringe to the environmental movement? Over the years, some really radical environmental groups have gone about beating spikes into trees so that anybody attempting to cut them might be injured. Is there anything like that going on in the area of animal rights?
I would preface it by saying this. All political movements have an extreme fringe. So the pro-life movement, as you know, has been marked by an extreme and very low percentage fringe movement that would advocate, for instance, civil disobedience up to and including violence to shut down abortion clinics.
Right.
So all political movements will have a fringe, not just progressive liberal, but also conservative and right wing will have a fringe that is unhinged from sort of pragmatic constraints. But to answer your question, the animal liberation movement and animal rights movement has always had a fringe. It waxes and wanes over time in generational cycles. 1870s, 1890s, 1920s, 1950s, emerging back in the 1980s. There will be a fringe that will liken animal use to slavery, and then, like John Brown, believe that the ends justify the means and that violence is necessitated to free animals. That would be the Animal Liberation Front and others. We are currently in a period where that has largely gone away. You sound old enough to remember back when Animal Liberation Front was attacking labs and burning things down. And
right.
That's largely gone away, but it will return. It's just gone dormant, sort of like a bad viral infection. But it will reemerge. And each time it reemerges, it tends to become more radicalized and more violent and extreme. So yes, the fringe is there. It's largely latent currently and hidden, and there's not much happening. However, you do see it becoming more radicalized again in England and in Europe. I don't know when it will happen here. But yes, you will have people that believe that animals, since there's no real distinction between non-human and human animals, oppressed, enslaved, and should be liberated through all means possible.
What's the ideal vision that these people hold? What sort of world do they imagine? Do they imagine the United States kind of like India, where cows are running around loose? What do they see as the ideal?
That's a wonderful question, and I'll put it back in terms of religion. A secularized utopian postmillennialism. Now, that's a big bunch of gobbledygook words, but basically instituting the Isaiah kingdom where lion lay down with lamb and that humans live in a peaceable kingdom where they minimize as much as feasible and possible their cruelty towards other living beings. The policy implications are profound, but as with all ideologues, they don't worry about the policy implications. What does this look like? Now, let's be practical. There's 8 billion chickens being raised. There might be more now. 8 billion chickens a year are raised for consumption. That's billion with a B in the United States. Mm. They won't say cut them all free. They would say just slowly over time grandfather them out. As they're consumed, you don't raise any more. you begin with the breeding herds from which you get chickens and cows and pigs, and you shut that down over time. There won't be any more meat consumption coming from farms. So they have policy proposals that seem somewhat feasible, but, you know, the thing I try to tell people when I talk to audiences, the biblical motif is without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sins. And for the Christian and for the religious believer, every time it's almost sacramental. Every time we consume an animal, we need to remind ourselves it gave its life so we could live. And it's a reminder of the sacrifice and atonement of Christ. And consciously remind ourselves to be thankful that God created a means for us to live. And that's one way to kind of inoculate yourself against their proposals.
Tell me about the book. What would Jesus really eat?
Well, I am philosophically, ideologically, and religiously opposed to the view that people should be prohibited from eating meat. And there are a number of theologians that represent that view. There is and was a concerted effort on the left of this issue to try to make the case that the Bible specifically prohibits animal agriculture, prohibits these sorts of things, and that meat eating is somehow immoral. It was a concentrated effort. So a group of us got together and said, look, if you look at church history and the actual text, it's clear. It's clear we can eat meat. Jesus ate meat, and he was a Jew. And in the new kingdom, he's obviously going to eat all kinds of meat. And then you talk about Peter and Acts getting down off the roof. You talk about in Timothy, where Paul talks about, and you know, talking about the end times, there's going to be people who try to prohibit you from eating meat or certain types of food. So what we said was, we just need to write a reasoned exposition of what the text actually says. Now, it was written from a Protestant perspective. There were both Reformed and Arminian theologians and philosophers in this, because, I mean, the thing about your faith tradition is the Pope's already addressed this authoritatively, I believe, in an encyclical, and also I believe that the Roman Catholic Catechism addresses this, that people may use animals for human benefit as long as they minimize pain and suffering.
Yes, that's true.
And so we felt all we need to do is just tell the truth. So you can disagree with the text, but the text is very clear. Jesus ate lamb and enjoyed it. And, you know, for instance, and I believe it's Mark, I don't have my text references in front of me, he clearly shows more regard for the one demoniac than the 2,000 pigs that cast themselves off the cliff and drown.
Good point.
And so all we needed to do was just, here's what it says, here's what church history says, and you really don't want to tangle with the Catholics because they've already wrestled with this. And so the devil's in the details, truly, because then the question becomes for Roman Catholics and also for Protestants, what does pain and suffering mean? That the real issue here is an aesthetic issue on defining what pain and suffering means. That's why the animal rights people are trying to define it as an equivalency to your pet animals. You will spend an enormous amount of money on a 17-year-old cat in veterinary bills, and yet you don't care about a pig that's obviously being abused. That's their basic premise. But that's why we wrote the book. Look, someone has to say the obvious here.
I assume the book is in general distribution and people can get it from Amazon and other places?
Yes, they can. What happened to us? We wrote it and got some fanfare, and then COVID hit.
Oh.
And the publishing business didn't collapse, but it really changed over COVID. And so we were going through a publisher and general distribution. And what COVID accelerated was the tendency already for distribution online through platforms like Amazon. And Amazon, for a book like ours, takes almost all, you know, you charge $9.99, $12.99, $18.99. They take almost all of that for Amazon.
Right. Yeah. I've had my own dealings with Amazon. I know what you're talking about.
So, Bill, what we thought before COVID was, let's go through a regular publishing house and try to get it out there rather than Amazon gobble it up. And then COVID hit, and that slowed down sales. The other option we've done, is, since it's written from a Protestant perspective, we've sent copies to prominent church pastors at larger churches who might be thought or opinion leaders in their communities. And just said, you know, here's an analysis of what's happening. You may find this interesting.
Do you have a website or any social network presence?
I kind of shut my stuff down because I was threatened with a lawsuit for saying these sorts of things. I came to learn that the other side takes this very seriously, And I have a loving wife and grown children now, but it was more or less, could we just kind of stay out of the public eye? Because you make yourself a target, and now I'm retired. I've been retired a year as an emeritus professor, and they kind of, I think, grant you a little bit of grace in the fact that you're kind of old and deteriorating and mentally unstable or something like that. But yeah, no. The short answer is no website, no social media. I shut all that stuff down because I just didn't want to get harangued.
Well, we may not generate any sales for you, but I am very grateful.
Okay.
I'm very grateful that you've taken a little time and illuminated this very complicated issue.
Yeah, for your listeners, I would say this. It's hiding in plain sight.
Hmm.
You know, the Confession, and I believe it's encyclical by Pope John Paul, addressed this issue. And it's pretty clear. Now, whether you want to abide by that's a different question. But I think doctrinally, your church has a stance on this issue. And for any Protestants that are listening, it's hiding in plain sight. Just read the text itself and look at church history and go. I encourage them to go out and eat baby back ribs, a rare T-bone, and chicken wings, and then praise the God who provided those animals as a sacrifice so that they could live.
Wes Jameson, What Would Jesus Really Eat? The Biblical Case for Eating Meat. Thank you very much. This is something that people don't think about, or most people in any event, and it's something that we should be aware of and consider very deeply. It actually has deep theological implications and moral implications, and people ought to give it some thought. I appreciate you taking time.
Bill, thank you for the invitation.
If you've been listening to these shows online but would like to hear them on the radio, tell your local Catholic station. Free Expression with Bill Castle is available for broadcast free of charge. Ask your Catholic station to contact us by email, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. That's B-I-L-L-K-A-S-S-E-L, all one word, billcastle@sbcglobal.net. And don't forget to support your local station. In this time of censorship and so-called cancel culture, Catholic radio is becoming increasingly important as an alternative media source. Your generosity keeps Catholic outlets on the air, and donations to broadcast ministries can be tax deductible. Be with us next time when we explore other aspects of religious communication and look deeper into the great Christian heritage of free expression. Free Expression with Bill Castle is a production of Good Shepherd Catholic Radio and Company Publications, where good books, good music, and good radio are always good company. Dan Curris provided technical assistance. Theme and incidental music are by Dan Adam. The program was produced and directed by Bill Castle. This is Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.